this episode of What's the Story, Old Glory, we focus on another of Trump's criminal cases. This time, it's the alleged hush money scandal that's being prosecuted in Manhattan, New York. We also talk about RFK Jr.'s new running mate, Nicole Shanahan. In Past Glory, we look at the president who inadvertently started the Presidential Records Act back in the 1970s. Tricky Dicky, Richard Nixon. Hello and welcome to What's the Story, Old Glory, the podcast that's counting down to the US 2024 presidential election. I'm Elizabeth Soule, and with me, as always, is my co-host, Todd Muller.
Greetings, and greetings to all our listeners. Well, it's starting to really take shape, isn't it? From when we kicked off last year at the first presidential debate, and now we're down to two. And as we will discuss today, there's down to two, but conversations around, you know, what the third parties, if any, what role they could play in this extraordinary election. But it's now definitely Donald Trump versus Joe Biden, which is, I guess, the rematch that part of us are really looking forward to because it's going to be so fascinating, but most of America don't seem to want.
Yeah, it's things are happening thick and fast every week now, and I guess that's going to be the case right up until the election as things really gear up. So yeah, we've got a lot to cover this episode, and no doubt there's going to be a lot happening in between now and November, like we say. So let's get into it, shall we?
Yeah, and the last time we caught up, Elizabeth, you were taking us through a tour de force of President Trump's indictments, which just seemed to go on and on and on, and any one of them would take out a New Zealand or a New Zealand politician, but you know he has 90 plus of them, and you did give us a little teaser, if that's the right word, that you were going to just step us through the hush money a trial. So why don't you reveal all, as they say, on that particular
issue? Sure. So this case is the oldest in terms of when the events are alleged to have occurred. It dates back to the 2016 election when Trump was first elected president. But it's the first that's likely to go ahead. It's due to kick off in a couple of weeks. And I've waded through the indictments. I've waded through the statements of facts for our dear listeners so that they don't have to. And there's something about this one that I perversely enjoyed reading about. I don't know if it's because it feels like it's something out of the 1990s. It involves a doorman, a Playboy model, an adult actress, and the National Enquirer. It just doesn't feel like it's got 2023 vibes about it.
No, it doesn't. It's sort of all those sort of date themselves a bit, don't they? So in what order do those particular players enter the stage? Why don't you step us through what is supposed to have happened?
Sure. So as we've talked about earlier, there is the classified documents case, which is a federal case against Trump, and then there is the election interference case, which is also the federal case being held in Washington, D.C., and then there's the case being brought by the state of Georgia for election interference, and this one is another state case, this time being brought by the state of New York. And the case, although it sounds very salacious, it really is a fraud case relating to payments made to people by Trump, his lawyers, and the Trump organization and trusts between 2015 and 2017. So a Republican strategist has said that, as reported in Time magazine last week, that this is the goofiest of all the cases that Trump is facing. But legal opinions that I've been reading, many of them believe that this could be the most clear cut in terms of it's pretty damning, the evidence against Trump, particularly because other people involved in the case have already pled guilty and have already served for some prison sentences relating to what happened in this case. So the district attorney for Manhattan, who's prosecuting the case, is Alvin Bragg, and he has stated that the core of the case is not about money for sex. but it's about conspiring to corrupt a presidential election and then lying in New York business records to cover it up. So Trump faces 34 indictments in this case altogether. They are all alleged violations of Section 175, subsection 10 of the New York Penal Law, which is about falsifying business records in the first degree. So the section states that a person is guilty of falsifying business records in the first degree where they commit the crime of falsifying business records and when their intent to defraud includes an intent to commit another crime. So we'll come back to that a bit later because that's quite critical in this case. So the statement of facts before the court says that Donald Trump orchestrated a scheme with others to influence the 2016 presidential election by identifying and purchasing negative information about him in order to suppress its publication and to benefit his electoral prospects. So they also, he and the other participants in the scheme, which include his lawyers and representatives of the Trump organization, violated election laws and made false entries in business records and mischaracterized them for tax purposes. So one of the other parties involved in this, as I said, is the National Enquirer publication, which is owned by AMI, a media company. And what Trump and AMI did together was to develop what's known as a catch and kill scheme. So the National Enquirer through AMI met with Trump and his representatives and said, right, we need to find, they were supporters of Trump before the election. And they said, we agree that we'll find stories, negative stories about Trump, and we will purchase the rights to them and then not publish them. And so that's the catch and the kill part of the scheme. And so that they would have to pay money to the people who had come up with the stories. So the first one was in November 2015, when AMI discovered that Trump's former doorman was trying to sell a story to the media, claiming that he knew that there was a child that Trump had allegedly fathered out of wedlock. AMI agreed to pay the doorman $30,000 for exclusive rights to the story, and they then never published it. The payments were falsely characterized in AMI's books and general ledger, and AMI later concluded that the story wasn't true, but the doorman still wasn't released from the agreement until after the 2016 election. Then in June 2016, AMI got in contact with former Playboy model Karen McDougal, who in the indictments and the statement of facts is known as Woman One. And she claimed that she'd had a 10-month affair with Trump. AMI paid her $150,000 for her agreement not to speak publicly and for her to have two magazine covers and a series of articles written under her name. And then the one that's gotten the most sort of press is in 2016, Lawyer A, who is actually Michael Cohen, then was alleged to have paid $131,000 to ex-adult film actress Stormy Daniels to prevent her publicising what she claims was a sexual encounter with Trump. So Cohen paid the money to Stormy Daniels, $131,000. And after that, Trump is alleged to have reimbursed Cohen with monthly checks from his trust and personal bank accounts. And these payments were allegedly disguised as payments for legal services rendered. So Cohen was one of Trump's lawyers, but there was no retainer agreement in place, nor did Cohen actually provide any of the legal services that were put on the false invoices or receipts, which were rendered by and to Cohen during that time. So he was paid back in monthly installments for several months. So the reason there's so many indictments is because every single one of those payments, whether it's to AMI or to Cohen and then on to Stormy Daniels, because there were so many of them, each of them is alleged to have been in breach of the penal code. So that's why there are 34 charges in all. Now, when I said before about falsifying business records in the first degree as a Class E felony, there was a bit of controversy when these charges were drawn up because the fact that it's a first degree offence means that, as I said, it's to with the intent of committing another crime. And the other crime that, that New York is alleging that, that Trump did was to affect the election results. And therefore, this, if it had not been anything to do with election, it would have been fraud in the second degree, which would carry with it much reduced sentences. So the sentence if found guilty for a Class E felony in New York is a mandatory imprisonment for a term not exceeding 4 years, but that's for each count. So in theory, if he was found guilty of each of the 34 counts, he could have a maximum of 4 years in prison for every single one of those 34 counts. Like I say, there's quite a lot of evidence in this case backing up the allegations that have been made. There are text messages and emails, particularly between Cohen and Trump and others, which demonstrate that Trump was in agreements with the payments being made. He wanted them made in cash, and he wanted them delayed as long as possible, hoping that they could delay until after the election, and then there would be no need for him to make them, because he said once I've won the election, it doesn't matter. They can say what they want. It can go out in public because I'll have already won. So Trump's team have been trying to delay this case like they have done with the others, but his latest attempt to delay it by 90 days didn't succeed. The judge has set the trial to begin on the 15th of April, and jury selection started last week. So this one is well underway, and it's likely to go for several weeks, and there's going to be some pretty exciting evidence come out of it. Like I say, Cohen has already pled guilty to his part in these proceedings and has already served a prison sentence. He is now one of Trump's loudest critics. And you can, he's written books, he's been in many media outlets, both online, podcasts, and in newspapers, talking about all the things he did. And really is anti-Trump now compared to where he previously was before he flipped, which was being one of Trump's biggest supporters.
Wow. So what strikes me listening to this is this, at one level, is has got nothing to do with the morals of having alleged affairs or not having alleged affairs. That is completely separate, really. I mean, it's the salacious framing, if you like, of the substantive story. But really what it is that they've got them in trouble here is the fact that they have deliberately gone out to, you know, to ensure that the stories never see the light of day, which in and of itself isn't illegal, I would have thought. It's the fact that they weren't open and transparent in terms of their business reporting and tax reporting about what those funds were used for. And so that's where they've got them, or allegedly have got them in this case, is
exactly
that it's the fact they weren't understandable at a level, if it's going to be a black ops sort of deal, which is clearly what he is trying to do here. But it's because they weren't open about it.
Yeah, it's a lot like, similar to, I should say, the case against Al Capone, you know, the famous gangster mafioso. Couldn't get him necessarily for any of the sorts of racketeering crimes and that sort of thing that he'd committed, but they got him on tax. So that's a similar sort of thing. And that's although it does seem, like you say, salacious, and because of the people involved and their previous occupations and professions, it seems like it's all very moral, but it's all about fraud, and it's all about things like check stubs, dockets, general ledgers and accounting and that sort of thing. So the actual counts being leveled against Trump are pretty dry in that respect.
So Trump, if he was sitting here, not that he ever will be, but he would say this is all part of a left-wing agenda to try and stop him from being successful in the 2024 election. It does strike me that other presidential candidates in other years would have gone to extraordinary lengths to ensure that the perhaps less desirable parts of their personal histories weren't ever able to see the light of day. And so that would have happened in the past, almost certainly. But so what's the difference in this case? If you're sort of looking at it, what's gone wrong for Trump here that others have done in previous elections and generations to ensure that either they find dirt on the other guy or that the dirt on them is sufficiently buried to not be a problem?
Yeah, I guess it's there's a number of things. Firstly, if it had just been a cash transaction, like, you know, handing over a brown paper bag on a park bench in Central Park or something, perhaps none of this would have ever come to light. But because it was done in a sham legal fashion through Cohen as Trump's lawyer and through AMI, the company that owned the news, the National Enquirer, there was a paper trail. There was an electronic record. It's also indicative, I think, of how stories, once they are now in our digital world, don't go away. Stormy Daniels, no one would have ever heard of her before. And you know, if it had been back in the days of regular tabloid journalism, where that's where the stories appeared, they probably would have been forgotten very soon after. But with the digital 24-hour news cycle that we have, these things have stayed high in the public's realm in terms of being brought up again and again. And also, you've got some, I wouldn't go so far to say that's publicly politically motivated, but certainly the prosecutors in some of these cases are dogged in their, you know, pursuit of Trump and just have not given up. And the slew of charges that he's facing across all these indictments, as we've talked about, are enormous. So there's a number of things, I think, that have gone into bringing Trump to accountability, if that's what's going to happen. And then also you've got people like Michael Cohen, who this is what happens within Trump's orbit. He has people that he brings on board who are pretty sycophantic and will do whatever he says. But then when the rubber hits the road, they, as he calls it, they flip on him. And he lost a lot of staff when he was in the White House last time. And a lot of people have been very vocal about what it was like to work for him, what his, you know, what his positions are on things and who he is as a person. And I think this is just indicative of he burns people along the way. So if you burn people along the way, you've got people that are willing to come after you after the fact.
Yeah. And there is nothing more damaging than someone who was your lawyer that got rid of stuff for you in an American context and a political American context to now suddenly be your greatest critic and will no doubt appear in court proceedings for the prosecution.
He is, yes, yep. And AMI have also done a deal with prosecutors in return for their testimony, so that they don't face further prosecution either. So it's like I say, there's some pretty damning evidence that Trump's going to have to try and counter in the court case as it unfolds over the next few weeks.
Very good.
Another interesting fact that I discovered in this research. We have talked previously about Trump being able to pardon himself if he does become elected president. Yes, interestingly, the powers of presidential pardon only apply to federal crimes, so not to state crimes. So if he is found guilty in Georgia and or he's found guilty in this case in New York, he cannot pardon himself from those. So that's completely uncharted territory. No one knows what that would mean for a president carrying out the role of the Oval Office from behind prison bars in Manhattan. I don't know what that would mean.
That is extraordinary. And in the conversations we've had, I think it's fair to say that the two cases which we think are possibly the most clear cut to our Bushman lawyer sort of antennas would be this one that the New York prosecution are running. And of course, the issue with respect to undue influence in the state of Georgia, find me those votes, which as we discussed at the time, seemed pretty clear cut to me that he was demanding that votes were found from anywhere to get him across the line. So, as you say, if he gets convicted in those two courts, then they stay with him.
Yeah, that's right. He has managed to post his bond this week, the $350-odd million cash bond that he was required to lodge in the court as part of the appeal process under his the Trump Organization civil cases that they were found guilty of inflating their business records and things for the purposes of getting loans. That was reduced by the court to $175 million, and he has posted that today. So he will be appealing that decision as we speak.
That was fascinating in itself, wasn't it? Because that first number was extraordinarily large, and even at the time, people were thinking that perhaps there was a case to suggest that it was overinflated, arguably, as a bail condition. And clearly a judge has found that it was, and he's found the money. Well, extraordinary.
From selling Bibles, gold shoes, and floating Trump Truth Social, had an IPO. It did really well at first, and now stock values are plummeting. So
yeah, as we speak, I think down to what I think 10% of its original value or something.
I just read something like that.
So I wonder if any of our listeners, because we do have quite a number from America, I'd wonder if they. If any of them have any money invested in Truth Social, if you do, reach out to us. We'd love to hear your perspective. So,
well, send us a picture of your shoes if anyone bought them, because I actually like them. They're gold with the American flag on them. I think they're quite cool, but they're too hard to come by now. They're all sold out.
I know. I actually thought they were quite cool too, bright. I mean, nothing if not overstated, but perhaps that's Donald J. Trump in a word. So we touched on at the start of this episode that we would have a quick look at third-party candidates, in particular one that has certainly got the profile and some momentum, and that is the third-party or independent campaign of Robert Kennedy Jr., the son of Bobby Kennedy, who himself was Attorney General in JFK's administration, was a senator in New York, stood for president in 1968 in that tumultuous presidential year, and tragically was assassinated. So it's his son. JFK obviously was his uncle. Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has created a role for himself in the political discourse of America as being very much at the margins, has very strong anti-vaccine perspectives, but is certainly a character with huge name recognition and tried initially to get the Democratic nomination. The Democratic Party put up all sorts of blocks at a state level from him participating. He got sick of that and peeled off and is now an independent candidate. The big news from his camp, Elizabeth, in the last week has been his announcement of Nicola Shanahan as his running mate. Now, she is a fascinating woman. I've had spent a bit of time just sort of researching her. I've never heard the name before. She's 38 years old. She was born in Oakland, California, to a Chinese immigrant mother and an American, Irish, German father. She herself, they had real tough upbringing. Her father was very much impacted by mental health, addiction issues. They really struggled to get by. She clearly brilliant woman. She twice married. Her second marriage to Sergey Brin, who co-started Google with Larry Page, means that she is a 38-year-old who has an asset base of north of $1 billion. So quite an extraordinary story. And I listened in to her introducing herself to America earlier this week, giving her first speech as the vice president nominee for the Robert Kennedy's run. And I thought I'd play a little bit of that for you.
My father loved my brother and I dearly, but he was very troubled, plagued by substance abuse, and he struggled to keep a job. From watching my father and his struggles, I learned not to be judgmental. He was doing the best he could. I think of him when I see the statistics of the millions of Americans who are addicted, depressed, or suffering. This is one of the epidemics of our time. It affects nearly every American family. I wish my experience was unusual, but it's not. It has become part of my determination to do something for our country.
So that was her introduction as to who she was, is her upbringing in that context. And she then, Elizabeth, went pretty quickly on to outlining what has been her focus, particularly over the last 10 years, in terms of her professional areas of concern, predominantly health related. She has had her own issues with IVF. She has a daughter, an only daughter, who has autism, and that has created for her a sense of real concern over how those issues are not being genuinely listened to and responded to as she would hope in America today, and really has evolved into a passion that chronic diseases in America have simply not been appropriately looked at and supported. And she outlines three main reasons for this. This is a little long, but it really gives you a sense, I think, of the flavor of where Bobby Kennedy and Nicola Shanahan are going to target their campaign.
One is the toxic substances in our environment, like endocrine disrupting chemicals in our food, water, and soil, like the pesticide residues, the industrial pollutants, the microplastics, the PFAs, the food additives, and the forever chemicals that have contaminated nearly every human cell. Yes, and it makes you angry to hear this. It makes me angry to say it because we shouldn't be here right now. Second is electromagnetic pollution. You don't hear politicians talking much about that either, but it is something we need to look at. As Bobby says, we need to investigate every possible cause of chronic disease epidemic that is devouring our nation from the inside. Third, I'm sorry to say, is our medications. Pharmaceutical medicine has its place, but no single safety study can assess the cumulative impact of one prescription on top of another prescription and one shot on top of another shot on top of another shot throughout the course of childhood. We just don't do that study right now, and we ought to. We can, and we will. Conditions like autism used to be 1 in 10,000. Now here in the state of California, it is 1 in 22. 1 in 22 children affected. Allergies, obesity, anxiety, depression, our children are not well. Our people are not well, and our country will not be well for very much longer if we don't heed this desperate call for attention.
So, quite a remarkable introduction to America from Nicola Shanahan. It really does sort of, I found it quite sharp and stark listening to that sort of language. We don't often, if at all, hear it in such a way framed up in a New Zealand context. But what did you think? That sort of, I thought, encapsulates sort of the Bobby Kennedy movement. It's more than just him being an anti-vaxxer. She actually isn't an anti-vaxxer, but you can tell from her perspective, she has quite unique views on what is causing America's ills. And, you know, I think there's an argument that as this campaign builds momentum, there's perhaps 4 or 5% of America, maybe more, who'd be willing to consider that instead of Trump and instead of Biden. What do you think?
Yeah, well, I didn't know. I'd never heard of her, like you say, before Kennedy made his announcement. And I received the email updates from his campaign just out of interest. And he had said that his running mate selection was going to be a game changer, wouldn't upset the political landscape and that sort of thing. And the cynics have said she's there to bring the cash. Like you say, she's very well connected in Silicon Valley. She's a very successful lawyer in and of her own right. So she does have a lot of funding behind her. But then to hear her speak like that about what she considers to be the reasons behind some of those health issues facing America and many Western countries, really, I now see how they get on so well, because she sort of weaved two of Kennedy's biggest platforms together. He has also been a very successful lawyer in terms of his, as an environmental lawyer, where he has taken down and not shied away from confronting big companies like petrochemical companies and that sort of thing. And then also with his anti-vax stance and his belief that, his erroneous belief that vaccines cause autism, obviously resonates with her on some level from her personal experience. And so I can see now why they make a good pairing together in terms of reflecting each other's values. And absolutely, I think there is a problem. I don't know if it's growing, but there is a not unsizable proportion of the American population that, particularly since COVID-19, is skeptical of big pharma, skeptical of big corporations, skeptical of the government's response to them. And they think that Kennedy is the outsider, even though he's very much from the inside of the political elite in America, but he's framing himself as the outsider who can bring truth and accountability to the government, which he's claiming aren't there now.
Absolutely. And when she finished her presentation, she made a pretty powerful pitch for the youth of America who are completely disconnected in their view from either the Republican Party and the Democratic Party. Have a listen.
Let me tell you why so many of us young people have turned away from politics. It's because we lost hope that change would ever come from inside the system. After all, which party wins with promises of hope and change or to drain the swamp? Things proceed as usual, declining bit by bit each passing year. So that's the reason. But the other reason is that we can't stand the phoniness anymore. We can't stand the lies. We can't stand the inauthenticity. And that's why Bobby Kennedy leads in all the polls among young people. We are hearing our voice in his. So I come to you today as a former Democrat. I come to you as a woman not quite 40. I come to you as someone who has experienced sickness and health and poverty and wealth. And I finally come to you as a mother.
So When I hear Robert Kennedy being interviewed and listen to his, I think, somewhat mad view around, the impact vaccines have had on a vast swathe of America's social and mental problems, it's easy for me to discount him as someone who's never going to have an impact in an election like this. Similarly, when I first listened to Nicola speaking, I was largely taken down that same path. But then I realized, and you've touched on this with your good insight there, Elizabeth, that people who will vote for Kennedy and Shanahan won't be voting for them because they are necessarily anti-vaxxers or because they necessarily agree with all of the platform, but because there are elements of what they say that actually reflects their dissatisfaction and disconnection with the current system. And the question then becomes, is there enough of them to make an impact on what will happen in the fiercely contested debate, a contest between Trump and Biden? Your thoughts?
Yeah, it's interesting that he has picked such a young female to be his running mate. I think that that's a smart move in terms of trying to expand his voter base. I'd be interested to do a fact check on whether Kennedy's ahead in all the polls with young people. I think that that's a slight exaggeration, but never mind. That they do, the campaign faces enormous challenges in terms of just getting what they call ballot access, which is even to be allowed on the ballots in various states. They all have different rules and they can be quite challenging. It's not as simple as in New Zealand it is to get on the general election. When, I don't know about you, but I'm always surprised when I rock up to the election booth and see just how many political parties there are, many of which I've never heard of before. Yep. So it is much harder to do that in America. But I don't think that they're ever going to, this is not a serious bid for presidency in terms of Kennedy's never going to win, but could have a serious effect on the results in terms of taking votes from either Trump, like Shanahan referred to there, people who were hoping that he would drain the swamp, but they've just had years and years of the same old in some respects, or disaffected Democrats like she and Kennedy are. So there's potentially an interesting sort of cross-section of voters that could go for Kennedy, take votes from either Trump or Biden, and have an outsized effect on who gets to be president at the end of the year.
Yes, and just to build on your observations there, Kennedy is in eight states, sorry. Mm-hmm. Nevada, Utah, Arizona, Georgia, South Carolina, New Hampshire, Michigan, and Hawaii. So whatever happens between now and November, when we come to the vote in those eight states, he will be there along with Biden and Trump for people to choose between. As you touched on, that's only eight. There's 42 to go. It's a very expensive process. Essentially, you need state by state a certain number of signatures from that state to ask essentially for ballot access for Kennedy. But each state has a different way of doing it. In California, that state requires 219,403 individual signatures, very precise number, by August.
I was going to say that's very specific.
It's extremely specific. Texas, 113,151, not by August, but by May the 13th, only 6 weeks away. And those 113,000 have to be proven to have not voted in the primary in Texas held a month or so ago. So that's just two examples of what states can do to make it difficult. Plus, of course, your list of signatures will then get challenged by the Democrat and Republican Party, often together, to ensure that you're not on the state, on that ballot. He's got a huge road to hoe, and I agree with you, Elizabeth, he's not going to win, he's not going to come close to it. But what are the current toss-up states? By toss-up, we mean that Biden and Trump are neck and neck, a percent or two apart from each other. They are Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Nevada, Michigan, Arizona, and Georgia. So four of the six toss-up states, already Kennedy will be on the ballot. And, you know, I've done a little bit of reflecting back on past elections, and those third party candidates, they haven't won. They're not names you have ever heard of. We don't do past glories with any of them, but they have had an impact. And I think probably the one that I will just focus on, the one that is the most recent, was the famous very neck and neck election between George Bush and Al Gore. 2000, yeah, that was the year 2000. It got down to Florida, a couple of thousand votes of that was the difference. And when you look at that electoral vote, Bush and Gore, basically the same amount of votes, in fact, Gore slightly ahead, and Ralph Nader from the Greens got 2.7%. And in each one of those close states that Gore lost to Bush, had Ralph Nader not been in the election, you would assume those green votes would have gone to Al Gore, and he would have won the presidency. Simple as that. And certainly the votes that Nader got in Florida, had they been cast for Gore, Gore would have been the president. That's just a simple a matter of fact. There are other close elections, 1992, and one we might cover shortly, 1968. It has happened. My sense that if ever there was a year, Elizabeth, that you would see an unpredictable vote turn go to an unpredictable candidate like Kennedy, perhaps this is the year.
Mm. He does have, like Nader, some celebrity endorsements, which some people cast scorn on, particularly with some of Kennedy's are a bit odd, like Rob Schneider and Alicia Silverstone, I think, is another one. Yeah. But for some people, that will resonate. That will you know, have an impact on who they decide to vote for. So, yeah, like you say, it really can make a difference in it, and it could do again this year. When I watched a Kennedy panel discussion last year, there were people saying that in their mind the perfect ticket would be a Trump Kennedy campaign, which is just so mind-boggling. But that speaks to, you know, the thinking that some of these voters are going through in their minds, that it's we are definitely, I've said it once and I'll say it again, we're in uncharted territory, and it's going to be a lot. They say a week is a long time in politics. Well, we've got all the way till November to go.
Yes, they do, and for good reason. We've got weeks and weeks of this in front of us, which is exciting. Very good. So I sort of hinted at it before. We've got a past president that it's now your turn to reflect on. Who have you chosen?
Well, I made my choice for this episode based on the fact that we've talked a bit about the Presidential Records Act, which is one of the acts in contention, the pieces of legislation that will be determinative in Trump's classified documents case in Florida. He is claiming that a lot of the documents that he took were personal records under the Presidential Records Act, which is usually meant to apply to things like greeting cards and that sort of thing. But the reason that that law was brought in was because of the 37th president, who was Richard Milhouse Nixon. And there have also been a lot of parallels drawn between Nixon's issues that he faced due to the Watergate scandal and what's also happened with Donald Trump. So I thought I'd look at Richard Nixon. I'm not going to go a lot into the policies that he enacted when he was president, because there's an awful lot of stuff that happened in foreign policy during the Cold War, but go take you back and talk a bit about his life before he served and how he came to be elected president. So he was born in 1913 on his family's Southern California lemon ranch. He had several brothers, and most of them were named after former kings of England. So he was actually named after Richard the Lionheart. It's just an interesting kind of thing to think about when one thinks of Richard Nixon.
Gosh.
So he went through school went to university and then went to law school from there. He graduated from Duke Law School and practiced commercial law in California before moving to Washington, D.C. In 1943. In response to the bombing of Pearl Harbor, he decided to join the U.S. Navy. So he served during World War II and received a Commendation Medal for Meritorious Conduct for his service in the South Pacific. He decided to run for the U.S. House of Representatives in one of the congressional districts in California. Allegedly, he was a very good poker player, even though he was raised a Quaker, and so the family outlawed gambling, swearing, drinking, and dancing. He was a very good poker player. And
there's not a lot left.
Yeah, and financed part of his first congressional bid with his winnings from poker games. He was elected to the U.S. House of Representatives for California, like I say, in 1947. He came to prominence in the American political scene because he sat on what was called the House Un-American Activities Committee. So this was the committee that was trying to root out spies, basically, at the end of the Second World War and then into the Cold War. He was then elected to the Senate in 1950, and this was when he was first given the moniker Tricky Dicky due to his slightly underhand campaign tactics. In the Senate, he supported statehood for Alaska and Hawaii, also civil rights for minorities, and federal disaster relief for India and Yugoslavia. So although he was very much a conservative, he was pro-civil rights and supporting US as a, you know, as an aid to other countries overseas. He then became vice president under Dwight Eisenhower, and he was only 39 at the time. This was in 1953. And even then, he was facing questions about dodgy campaign funding. And he went on national TV and spoke about how poor he and his wife were, and that they, although they had received gifts, it was things like a dog, which he gave to his daughter Trisha, called Checkers, things like that, and it all was forgiven. Apparently, it was one of the highest rated television events up till that point, and became very popular because of it. He ran for president in 1916 against JFK. Obviously, he lost that election. And then he also unsuccessfully ran for governor of California. He didn't run in the 1964 election, despite his name being on some RNC primary ballots. So his name was put on there, even though he didn't want to. After Kennedy was assassinated and there was the 1968 election, where Nixon ran with Spiro Agnew as his running mate. And this was one of the ones we were talking about earlier. It was a three-way election where votes were taken off two of the candidates by the third party, who was the Independent Party candidate, George Wallace, who had a lot to do with being anti-civil rights in America. So the Democrat that was being that was running also was Hubert Humphrey. And so the Electoral College votes of that election ended up Nixon 301 votes, Humphrey 191, and Wallace received 46. He was the first non-incumbent vice president to be elected, and then he was re-elected in 1972. Vice President Agnew had to resign in 1973. It didn't bode well for the president. He resigned due to crimes that Agnew had committed while he was governor of Maryland. And then Gerald Ford became vice president. Nixon was eventually brought down in 1974 by the Watergate scandal, which was the bugging of the Democrat headquarters at the Watergate Hotel, which was eventually linked to the White House and his re-election campaign. There were lots of documents related to it, and in particular, there were tapes that Nixon had made recording conversations that he'd had with people about Watergate when he was in the White House. And there was long legal wranglings as to whether those tapes were public property or belonged to the president himself, which led to the passing of the Presidential Records Act so that documents and tapes and that sort of thing were forevermore to be public records, not personal records of the president. And then, of course, he resigned before he could be impeached. And I've got a couple of quotes from him. First one is his resignation speech in 1974, where he said, "If some of my judgments were wrong, and some were wrong, they were made in what I believed at the time to be the best interest of the nation." And then he did the famous series of interviews with David Frost in 1977. And he said then, "When the president does it, that means it is not illegal," which is one of the core arguments that Trump is now running in his election interference campaign, that anything he did was not illegal because he was president at the time.
It's amazing. That's brilliant. It's amazing how history doesn't repeat, but by goodness me, it rhymes. there are just deep resonances from that period and that president playing out in front of us as we speak. I think, you know, that the symmetry of all the conversations we've had in the last three episodes about the President Records Act, which, you know, came from the Nixon era, which of course is what's, you know, one of the things that are tripping up President Trump in terms of, you know, who owns what classified material. Is it the president's to take home and leave in a bathroom, mm-hmm. or is it actually critical information that stays the property of the United States government? The other thing that jumps out when you reflect on that Nixon period is Nixon did not know that Watergate was being bugged or that it happened. He did find out it did happen and then decided actually it would be best if no one else knew about it. And ultimately he got, you know, hung on that petard, and that was enough to destroy his presidency. But you, when you compare that to the 95 indictments that hangs over former President Trump, my goodness.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, Nixon comes across as a saint, which is saying something. I mean, what do you think when you see the comparison?
Yeah, it is. It's funny in a way, because Nixon is widely portrayed in, you know, popular culture and things as being a crook and a terrible president. But yeah, compared to the things that Trump is alleged to have done, it really does sort of pale into significance. And interestingly, about that public records, there has been a development in the Florida case this week about it, because the trial judge is a Trump appointee, and the judge has come out and issued draft jury instructions. So basically this is giving the jury instructions about what they can and cannot decide upon when they're finding facts in the case, for the opposing lawyers to provide feedback to the court on what they think about these jury instructions, which I find bizarre in the first place. But it's even more bizarre what the judge has said, proposing that the jury be instructed that they are able to find that any records the president can classify as being personal at any given time for any reason they desire. And so that essentially would give Trump, it would pardon him. It would, you know, that if they found that and that was the instruction to the jury, they would have to find him not guilty, because all he would have to say is they're personal, done. And in theory, if that had been the same with Nixon, he could have said, "No, you can't have the tapes, they're mine. Done. Case closed." So it's interesting. It's definitely going to be watch this space.
Absolutely, which is ironically what Nixon's argument was.
Yes, exactly.
There should be no expectation on what I say as the president in the Oval Office on any given topic, on any given day, to be made public. They are my conversations. And of course, you know, ultimately they were made.
Really shouldn't have recorded them. Doesn't seem like a smart move.
No, but of course now they're phenomenal. You know, I assume every president's conversation now is recorded for posterity. Does that still happen? And then get along
only
access
some.
To only some.
Yeah, like yeah, he was recording everything, every conversation he had with anyone. He pretty much hit record, and that was part of the issue is that everything was on tape.
Yes, it started the moment the phone got lifted. Mm. It was top-end technology back in 1968. I bet he wished to have it. But that's brilliant, Elizabeth. Thank you. And so we've traversed quite a bit in this this latest episode, and you know, we'll be back in short order to reflect on the next week or so that unfolds in front of us. So. I hope you're enjoying it. Appreciate the feedback that we get. Until next time, from Todd Muller, haere rā.
And from Elizabeth Soule, mā te wā.
What's the Story Old Glory is written, produced, edited and presented by Elizabeth Soule and Todd Muller for Old Glory Casting. Our cover art is by Caitlin at Studio Naylor. Our theme music is Shootout at Sundown by Del Boni. You can find us on all the usual social media channels at Old Glory Pod and send us your questions to oldglorypod@gmail.com.